The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Management of chronic coronary syndromes is presented by Dr. Robert Chilton.
Okay, so everybody's here for the board, so let's get started with these and go through them. This has shifted a little bit because I think the board exams are, as everywhere, have changed some of their questions in the way and what they expect you to know. So to start with, we're going to talk about ischemic disease. And I don't know if the cable's loose back there or not, but the color's not quite right. And I don't know if you can turn down the front lights a little bit because these guys aren't going to be able to see these slides. Up here on the slide is the thing that is the single most important to ischemic heart disease is actually these two curves. One of these curves actually takes a look at the demand of the heart, and you can see there are four listed there. You need to know these because these are important to you. And on the side is the supply. In this section, since we'll talk about interventions later, we're going to work on both sides. I'm going to talk about the demand side if you can't go to bypass surgery or you've already been there and you've already had PCIs and it didn't work, and then you'll need to know the drugs. And at the same time, on the other side, all those things are important. The flow, the heart rate, diastolic volumes, those things come into play. And then I'll ask you a few things about actually physically examine some of these people with heart disease. This is an important one. This is the law of Laplace. And basically what this shows is if you want to take the workload off the heart, you're going to have to slow the heart rate down, but especially take the blood pressure down. Those two things, heart rate and blood pressure, are probably the biggest ones. Of those two, heart rate is probably the very most important. The other thing that eats up oxygen to the heart is how thick the heart is. If you have left ventricular hypertrophy, you will eat up more oxygen or fuel than somebody that actually has a normal-sized ventricle. So it does make a difference. How big is your heart? If you have a basketball-sized like heart, then you won't do as well as a guy with a football-looking heart that's more of a cylindrical look to it. That's the way you were born, and that's what it should be. But this is the law of Laplace. It fits everything in physiology with relation to the heart. This is an exam question, and I hope that you could pick this out. I'm not going to spend much time on it, and the reason is because we only have 27 minutes to go through this, and it's probably more important than I tell you things that I feel like you're going to miss. The very bottom answer is right. It's the heart rate is number one, the blood pressure is number two, and the size of that ventricle is number three. So if you use anti-angiogenic medicine, obviously beta blockers are really right up front. Drugs like diltiazem that slow the heart rate are really up front. You want the blood pressure low. You use chlorothalidone to lower blood pressure because it decreases preload. It carries mortality benefit, but not hydrochlorothiazide. It only lowers your blood pressure, but doesn't decrease mortality. That came out of the Mr. Fit trial. The next thing is you need the ventricle to be as small as you can. The volume is important. Obviously, that relates to heart failure. You know, you can take off fluid to some extent, but changing the ventricular volume is something you really don't have drugs for. So those are probably some of the more important ones. The next thing is, let me show you what happens in people at CAS. You see those high-grade blocks on there, and then if you go through here and you look for angina, you'll watch this optical coherence tomography picture, and you'll see it blow out the entire side of the ventricle. It'll go straight up at 12 o'clock. That's a ruptured plaque. There she blows out at the very top. You can see it. That is the thing that most of us are after to try to prevent. The best thing to prevent something from rupturing in your coronary or any other part of your vascular bed, lower your blood pressure, decrease your shear force, your heart rate, and that probably is the two best choices that you would have. This is actually something you don't normally see. This is a glycocalyx. You just need to look at this because if I can teach you the translational biology, there's nothing they can throw at you that you won't understand. On your blood vessels, below the endothelial, just above the endothelial lining, is some hair-like vessels. They actually flow in the actual stream of blood. They look like seaweed. That seaweed has an ability to protect the actual endothelial lining from damage. It's a 5-micron layer. That layer is damaged when people smoke, when people have high lipids, high oxidative stress related to diabetes and things like that. What you want to do is keep that from getting damaged, because if you tear that or you knock the endothelial lining off that glycocalyx, then what will happen is platelets and white cells will come there and start an inflammatory reaction, and you will get atherosclerosis. Now, I look in the audience, and it looks like most of you guys are long-distance runners, which cleans your endothelium. I assume most of you ate a very low-carbohydrate breakfast, which decreases your triglycerides, that damages that endothelial layer. Your endothelial layer is damaged for 4 hours after you eat high-carbohydrate food. That means your brain doesn't function as well, and your coronary arteries are smaller. So if you feel a little sluggish this morning, you have 4 hours to clear it. And after that, you'll go back to functioning again. This is an example of a young guy. This guy is something like 38 years old. And if you looked at the picture, the one in red, in 8 months, developed that. He's 38. He was fine. And then he starts getting chest pain. So they say, well, why are you cathing him again? He just got cath 6 months ago. Because he had chest pain that was pretty classic. And he ends up having a high-grade block. He ruptured a plaque. Best control heart rate, blood pressure, and decrease all of your environmental risk factors that you can. That's probably the very best. And there simply shows you the blockage down at the bottom. And again, the things that go along with that is people that have diabetes, people that have hypertension, all those need to be controlled with lifestyle modification and chronic stable angina. That's something you really want to control as best that you can. The most important thing for demand would be heart rate. There's your blood pressure, and then there's your LV volume and contractility. Those are the major players for demand side of the equation. Remember, if you have a fixed obstruction and you can't change that, the only thing you have left to do is to decrease the demand. And again, just like in your car, if you're using gasoline up at 100 miles an hour, you can slow it down and it will use less fuel. So that's probably, again, the better choice. And that just simply shows you his coronary again. So for physical examination, I don't know if many of you would guess this right or not. This is what we ask the medical students. Physical exam, not doing an EKG, the physical, what do you find during angina? One is the heart rate usually a little bit higher during the time they're having angina. The other one is they have an increase in blood pressure when they have angina. Your body's kicking out adrenaline, try to compensate. You should hear a third and fourth heart sound. And you might hear mitral regurgitation. So on the board exams, if they give you people who actually change their sounds and things like that, you might consider chronic stable angina, because if you have a third sound, that's going to tell you that heart's ischemic. That one wall is out of blood. But on the other hand, if they give you somebody with squirrely chest pain, and the guy has, and they tell you so far in the text, you read it and it says blood pressure is normal, heart rate doesn't change, and the guy has no S3 and S4, they're targeting this piece of data. And this is, again, back to medical school, this is what we would train you on. The clinical basic things is for actually chest discomfort on exertion. That would be probably a good predictable sign. The guy's probably got true ischemic disease. You speed up the engine, you have a fixed block, you're going to get ischemia. There is silent ischemia, but it's kind of difficult to actually identify it. If they ask you a silent ischemia versus somebody have chest pain, do you get a cardiovascular benefit by bypass surgery if a guy has 3-vessel left main disease? You do. Now, that's not been talked about as much, but silent ischemia kills at the same rate as regular ischemia. And maybe in some respects it's more dangerous because the patient doesn't know he has it. That might show up on a Holter, but those people get the same treatment as a person that has classic angina. So don't forget, silent ischemia is just as bad. Nitro should relieve the pain. However, nitro released gallbladder pain and a bunch of other things. So it's only partially accurate for what you want to do. And then again, if you rest, it should go away. Now, in the morning hours, it is well known that your coronaries are a third smaller. There's a thing called walk-through angina. That occurs because a person's brain recalibrates from rhythms from the brain and actually vasodilates after the first 4 or 5 hours in the morning. And so many patients can do quite well in the afternoon, but in the morning, they certainly struggle. And some of my patients that can't have any more interventions actually take nitro when they get up in the morning because they're going to get it when they get to the bathroom. So again, watch the careful question, and they'll probably give you an idea. Now, this is by the guidelines, and these are the guidelines are certainly based for both of us, and this is ischemic heart disease guidelines. This is the 2017. It's about the latest that I have. There's some data from the 2014 that are very common principles that you probably need to know. So if you take a look at the very first 9 most important things, and this is in your handout, you have to know these. Many of us write questions for the boards. Okay, we will take questions from the guideline papers. Always read the guideline papers. So if you don't read anything, at least read the top 10 or top 9. So history with a negative stress test but has clinical suspicions of coronary disease, that guy has a goes to the cath lab. He gets a 2. He's not a class 1. So again, you could treat him medically with drugs because he's not going to have any worse outcome. Some people say you should cath the guy. Some people say you shouldn't. So if they ask you, you don't just have to cath every patient that has a twinge of angina. If a patient has intermediate risk but is unable to do a stress test, then you probably could cath the guy. That's very reasonable. You are the referring doc most of the time. So it will be on your shoulders to decide whether he goes for the cardiology consult. But again, you have a huge amount of input into what happens to the patient. If he gets to the cath lab, and let's say the guy gets in there and the doc calls back and says, listen, you know, I have a lesion here at 60%. I'm not sure what to do with this. There's a thing called fractional flow reserve, or FFR. This is dropped into your information base now, too. Those people can have it done on the cath table, and all we're doing is measuring a pressure across a lesion. Those guys then will be able to be determined whether they should have a stent placed or whether they should go someone else. That is something we do all the time, and it's fair game for you guys because it's in the stable ischemic heart disease guidelines, and that's part of your stuff. The other thing that's a brand new one that I saw in there, and I can't imagine they would ask you a question. If somebody, and they gave a patient to you that's taking infusion of EDTA, and you say that's a class 3 indication, it used to be, but now they've moved it to a class 2 because they have a new evidence that shows that maybe it reduces cardiovascular events. So that's kind of one of those tricky ones that you would think, no, I'm not going to do that, but actually that it's possible you could do it. External counterpulsation. Yes, for somebody that's refractory angina that you have not controlled with the standard multitude of drugs and interventions if possible and surgery if possible, that would fall into a class 2B. It is contraindicated in a couple of people. They would more likely ask you this. If you have decompensated heart failure, if you go on to external counterpulsation, you will increase the afterload on the ventricle and put him into florid pulmonary edema. Not a good idea. If a guy has a huge leak in his aortic valve and you put him on it, it's going to leak backwards into the left ventricle. That's not a good idea. And if you're using it on his legs, which you probably are, and he has peripheral arterial disease, that's probably not a good idea. So those are going to fall in areas that you probably don't want to be doing. That's a class 3, so don't do that. If a patient has diabetes and he's complex and they ask you and the cardiology guy calls you and says, you know, listen, I've got a patient that's got this, you know, I'm not sure what to do. If he has diabetes, I would get a heart team approach. If they ever offer you heart team approach, take it. You probably got the right answer. Because what we're saying is we want more than one person to buy in on what you got planned because it's a tough patient. For left main, nobody beats a CABG. If you have a high-grade left main or they ask you about that and the patient has something quite significant, you need to go to have a bypass with a left internal mammary artery. The left internal mammary artery improves survival, and I'll show you those curves in just a minute. Down at the very bottom is actually the FREEDOM trial. The FREEDOM trial was done in people that you take care of that have diabetes, that have heart disease. Well, what you see is that the actual bypass beat every one of these areas. So if you have diabetes, unless there's some special reason, you probably should be going to bypass. Now, let me show you the sad part of it is. This is just for your own information. If you get a bypass versus a PCI at 5 years, what's the rate of return for death, non-fatal MI, or stroke? You can see PCI, 25% of the people come back in 5 years if you get a PCI, but nearly 20% come back with a CABG at 5 years. So you better not get to either one of those if you can protect yourself, because neither one gives me the information that I really want. 25% or 20% coming back in 5-year rate, I hope to live longer than 5 years. And I don't want to come back in 10 years and look at those numbers, that'd be 50% and 40%. That's pretty high. So try again. Do your best to keep the primary prevention at the front of your game. This simply shows revascularization to improve survival. The catch on this slide is survival. This is unprotected left main. I have an arrow showing you what the referring guy may say from the cath lab. For that guy, it is a class 1 indication to actually go for bypass surgery with a heart team approach. That is usually not an interventional case. But if you told me the patient had cancer, short life expectancy, can't take anticoagulants or whatever, then you might want to consider that. I mean, there are patients who get radiated. I had a young guy yesterday that was 37 years old or had already had his lymphoma radiated, and he could not go to surgery because he wouldn't heal. We did his left main. But those are special cases. And again, heart team approach is what you have to do. There's some examples there of a diabetes patient, and you can see the tremendous blockages in his coronary artery. Over here takes a look, again, to improve survival, again, compared to medical treatment. Unprotected left main and CABG still comes out to be number one on the list. Now, notice this left main is different. In the picture, it shows the arrow at the very bottom of the left main. You see the catheter go down. You see it go into the left main coronary. And then just before it divides, it's high grade. That is not one you want to do interventions on. The reason is, it's very hard to protect the other branch. Even if I put an Impella in or put them on tandem heart, it's still a risky procedure. Those patients do far better with bypass. Don't let some cowboy do intervention there, unless, again, it's contraindicated because the guy can't have bypass. Then it's a very difficult problem, and none of us like doing those. This is another one you need to be aware of. This is called the STS score. The Syntec score. They're both very similar to each other. We use these, and these are now falling into class 2. Any patient that you want to send for bypass or PCI, they're recommending that be on the chart, and there's a calculator for that. And let me back up one if I can here. This is the things that are actually asked in the calculation. They want to know the age. Now, why would I tell you how to calculate it? Because you say, I don't have to do that. You want to see what kills people. These are the things, if they ask you board questions and they put them in, and they tell you the patient's an older person, he's got bad kidneys, the guy's got a left ventricle that's bad, and the guy's got a left main, and you divide men or women, they're a little bit different, but COPD, peripheral vascular disease, those are the things, those are the key items that go into the score that mortality is calculated off of, and it's really good. So for me in the cath lab, I always look at the kidney. I can look at the patient's age and their face most of the time. The ventricle, if it's bad or he's got a left main, I can see that. I calculate these, my fellows do, on every one of my cases. You have to know these scores. If they're really high, they tend to go to bypass surgery because that has a better outcome for survival for them. Now, I asked you this question earlier. If a patient presents with a strong angina history, no diabetes, and his angiogram shows complex three-vessel disease, and he has a score that is actually greater than 22, then that guy is going to fall into this category. Here's the anatomic setting. He's got three-vessel disease with or without left anterior disease. He goes to CABG. It's got the arrow on the answer. So complex disease, left main, send this guy to surgery. That's the best choice. If the guy has, for example, two-vessel disease, a right coronary artery blocked or another one, and he has a left main, left anterior descending artery blockage, he still goes to CABG. Survival is by and large best with the surgery. Now, there are people who don't get survival benefits, don't have a left main, don't have a prox LED. Then it's kind of a dealer's choice, unless your ventricle is bad. If you have a poor ejection fraction, then you're probably better off with a bypass surgery than you are with intervention. But if it becomes so poor the surgeon can't operate it, it will come back to intervention as a palliative procedure. The only thing that separates the intervention just for, you know, it makes you feel better, is that if you have blockages in your heart, and we can tell you the high-grade blockage is tight, if I do an intervention, you have less returns for actual cardiovascular events. That comes out of the FAME trial, and that's talked about quite a bit. This is an example of a high-grade left anterior descending disease that you can see. Here's a lady that was symptomatic. And if you take a look at the guidelines, those are going to fall into class two, one down at the very bottom. At the very top, you have the actual 2A, which is a LEMA for long-term benefit for a CABG, but that's not a class one. But if you look at the very bottom, the bottom arrow, I want you to look at that one. If a person has died and they brought them into the hospital, sudden death or presumed ischemic mediated VTAC, that's a class one. That patient needs a bypass because that's the ischemia that's related to it. So watch for that one. The catch is there. It's sudden death, and it's also at the same time presumed ischemic VTAC. Those go into surgery. You can do an intervention, but by and large, most of the data would support surgery. Surgery gets the edge because it gets a B classification. It means the better data for it. C is not quite as good. But if a guy wants to do intervention, it's okay. Either one would be fine. Now, this one is kind of for your own information. If you have a person that's got a low ejection fraction into the CCU, for example, has, again, a lot of segmental wall motion abnormalities, either by echo or if the person actually has a nuclear scan, the annual death rate or MI percentage would fall into these categories, and I'll show you the high-risk categories. The answer's four at the bottom. That's a high-risk patient. Most of you in this room aren't going to be hitting five or six for 10 years, not in through 1 year. I mean, that's just way too high. I'll give you a kind of an idea of the ground. If you have ischemic heart disease and you're a person that has diabetes, your event rate per year is about 2%. If you have a non-STEMI, then your event rate is about 7 to 8% per year. So this one is a person that comes in and has all the bad risk factors, low EF, and at the same time a lot of abnormalities on their score. That guy's going to be more than 3%. This shows you the actual high-risk features. This is one that probably, again, you need to look at just before the exam. Any of these on here is going to push you more towards a surgical endpoint than anything else. But you can see, again, the stiff ventricle that dilates up when you exercise them, or a person that gets angina at a low risk. If they give you a patient who cannot walk far on the treadmill, then that guy is high risk because he may have actual power failure. Or if they give you a guy that exercises on the treadmill and his blood pressure starts going up and then it starts going down and they continue exercise, that's a bad sign too. That guy needs a heart catheterization. If they give you somebody that's got a very high calcium score, you can see the one at the bottom, number 9, 400, over 100 is abnormal. It correlates pretty well with bad outcomes, and certainly that guy would be high risk. But I think most of those on there you would probably figure out, but those are just some real important ones that you need to know. This is the actual per year mortality on a patient that you would have that would have one vessel, two vessel, or three vessel disease. If a guy has one vessel disease, he again has a 1.4% mortality. This is dying in 1 year. And you can see three vessel with Prox LED, 8% would die in 1 year. So if somebody has three vessel disease that you're taking care of and they can't operate him and they can't do a PCI on him, because his chance of dying is almost 10% per year. He is not going to be around long. So that's kind of what it comes, and that comes from thousands of angiograms over time. That's been pretty much of a standard for most of the boards. So landmark trials, this is a COURAGE trial, which I participated in, and I think I got the most interventions in the entire trial, so you can blame it on me if interventions didn't go well. This is the outcome. We really, on routine chronic stable angina, medical treatment works. This is a compared against PCI with stents, and actually they do fairly well. However, there's kind of a catch to it. If you look towards the last part of some of these trials, on the COURAGE trial, this is the FREEDOM, but let me show you what happened to COURAGE. At the very bottom, we found that CABG is doing better on some of the patients with real bad angina in the COURAGE trial. So you should, if the guy's got really bad angina, you need to go to surgery or to cath for an intervention. This is the FREEDOM trial shown here. The FREEDOM trial's diabetes. You paid for this. This cost you $10 million this is a super expensive trial. This is diabetes guys that have multivessel disease. Which one does better? Got diabetes? The curve's pretty clear. Cabbage wins. So if you go out 5 years, but remember what I showed you earlier, even though you win, you still have near 20% at 5-year event rate, and that's not really good. If you look at PCI, it's nearly 26%. So best, don't get diabetes. That means stay skinny as you can, run for your life, and pick the right parents, okay? If you didn't pick your parents, it's a problem. Another thing, just from the basic science side, if you stay on the ketotic side a little bit and you exercise a lot, those ketones turn down a thing called the inflammasome. The inflammasome is what drives the immune reaction to upregulate interleukin-1 beta, which turns on in your liver C-reactive protein, which then turns on inflammatory signals to bring white cells down to damage your endothelial wall. That's how you get atherosclerosis. Your parents actually give you genes that will control these inflammasomes. You and your diet control your inflammasomes. And if you change your upregulation of your innate immune system, you will also give it to your children as offspring. You want to stay as healthy as you can your entire life. Okay? It all makes sense when you come down to basic science. So watch it. You don't want anybody that don't brush your teeth. You want to have excellent health. You don't want any infections throughout your blood vessels. This is what drives all these processes. Everything you see here that I'm doing is I'm either cutting you open and putting in a bypass graft with a Lima, or you're getting a stent, or I'm giving you medicines. I'm just palliating a disease that's 60,000 miles long. It's all over your body. You think that I can just fix the heart? I can stent 2 feet of the heart and that's all. So it's really important that you do lifestyle up front. That's probably your most single important thing. Here's the FFR data. That's how we measure the pressures. I have one pressure point on one side and one on the other side of the lesion. And then if you follow up the patients, you can see that the ones that have FR guided had less returns to the hospital. So you do better if the guys will actually, again, take their medicines. But at the same time, in the cath lab, they can tell you if that blockage that looks like a 50 is significant. How many times do you think we guess correctly if we say, oh, it's only a 60% lesion? A lot of those are tight, but a lot of the ones that you tell me that are 70% aren't tight. I don't fix those. I don't cause a new disease. If I give you a stent, I give you a disease you cannot treat if you get in-stent restenosis. I have no treatment other than go back to the lab. You have atherosclerosis. I can treat that with statins, blood pressure agents, and things like that. But I can't treat atherosclerosis when I put a stent on top, because that stent in itself gave you a new disease. So you're treating one for the other. So again, best choice is to stay as healthy as you can, as long as you can. This simply shows you some more of the guidelines here. You can read these at your leisure, but it's simply, this is data that shows you the invasive testing for cath and people that should have it on the treadmill. I've covered most of this in my comments. This one here simply shows you the focused update. And again, notice the heart team approach. I just want to say, watch out for heart team. That's a big thing for the exams. We like to put it in there. That tells me you talk to your colleague. That tells me the patient will get a better input. You would be surprised when you get together. One guy will say, well, did you know he had this? Oh, I didn't know he had that. So it will change what you do. So again, heart team approach is pretty easy. Closing slides on translational biology, where I live, and that's what I do research on. Here is the blood pressure, and this is the law of Laplace. Just to reiterate, heart rate is the single most important thing. If the guy has angina, slow him down. How slow can you get him? Can you stop his heart with a beta blocker? You can't do it. If you stop his heart with a beta blocker, he has sick sinus syndrome. So it's not a problem. So lower his blood pressure and then take the workload off of the ventricle by lowering his blood pressure. That's, again, the other big parts of that equation that you can mess with. This is the actual cellular signal that occurs. Nitric oxide is your life. If you do not exercise, you do not secrete much nitric oxide. All of you sitting here have endothelial cells that look like a cuboid. But when you exercise, they become elongated and they look more like trapezoids and they kick out nitric oxide that protects your endothelial lining and actually puts a Teflon layer across all of your blood vessels. You want to keep that there, and again, eating the proper foods will keep the nitric oxide levels high. If you eat foods that are high in saturated fat, you will shut this off nearly completely. If you have diabetes, you took 50% off of it. If you have inflammatory disease, you took 50% off of it. Nitric oxide is what's driving all these signals, and you want to keep it as good as you can. Here again is the guy that was 30 years old. There he was 8 months before, had a normal coronary at the top. Look at the bottom and look at his history. He is the classic Texas San Antonio cowboy. He's Hispanic in background, hemoglobin A1C is high, obese, low HDL, high triglycerides, and he's got biopsy-proven NASH, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. It all fits together. This guy is very high risk. He will be back to see me. Now, the part that will come back to see me, believe it or not, in my last 40 seconds, is the part at the red arrow. You guys think that has plenty of blood and is really large. Everything going around the outside rim of that intravascular ultrasound in the red arrow is what we call near-infrared spectroscopy. That is telling me how much fat is actually in his artery. It's completely loaded. So you raise his blood pressure, or you have him heart rate go up, he's likely to fracture plaque and come back and see me again. And here at the top is more of the same thing, and you can see a wide open artery, but it's loaded with fat all the way around it.